I was brought up in a musical family, and I was born in Belgium. My father is a musicologist and a teacher at the University of Byzantine Music. And you should know that in the conservatories, especially in Greece, when you get your diplomas and your specialty in music performance, in chant, you also get the certification for teaching traditional music. So it's Byzantine music and traditional music. So the certificate includes the teaching of traditional music, since they share the same modes, and one is, you know, the direct continuation of the other. Even if thematically we move away from the liturgical to the paraliturgical and then to the non-liturgical, traditional, even secular and pagan and whatnot. But the music structure and the theory is common and shared between all of the music that we perform in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the former Eastern Roman Empire that was Byzantium for the Westerners, and we know it as the Romaiki Autokratoria, and then, you know, the Hellenic Republic later on. But so I was brought up in a household that was very musically inclusive, and I did both classical and Greek traditional and liturgical music growing up, and things were presented to me, and in the beginning, of course, you don't really have a choice of what music your parents are going to be listening to, but thankfully it made for very powerful musical experiences that allowed me to personally embrace and seek to be directed and musically disciplined in this tradition. So growing up from very early on, I would sing in choruses and take piano lessons and begin to chant. And following with my father on his trip to Mount Athos when I was six, I attended an all-night vigil, and this is a very extensive liturgical service that starts in the late evening and finishes the morning after. So it's kind of usually 12, 14 hours of liturgical immersion. And of course, you have the freedom of moving in and out of the church. You're not locked in the, you know, in the chapel or the cathedral. So as a kid, I was trying to take it all in. It was on Mount Athos again, a medieval castle. And it was a very extraordinary first experience for me. The nature and the architecture and the music that went along. And when you have 20 and 40 and all of the church singing together, and you are in the middle of it all, you know, you're just moved to stillness. And I was overwhelmed by the beauty of specific songs that they were singing, hymnody, and I was trying to remember it so that I can ask my father the following morning to teach me, you know, those things that I was listening to. And thankfully for that, I can say that I chose this as my discipline and my work and my study growing up. And I added, you know, many other genres of music in my teaching and singing and performance repertoire, to include, of course, Western music and classical music, medieval, and even more contemporary and experimental music, and even jazz in my performance, let's say. But my expertise is the Greek music and the liturgical music of the Byzantine, post-Byzantine and contemporary Greek tradition. And I am happy to also embrace other art forms and to include bel canto, and we've studied, you know, voice with opera instructors. But again, what I'm most known for is the music of the liturgical Eastern Roman Empire that survived in our days in our liturgical tradition in the Greek Orthodox Church. And this is what brought me to Oakland and the metropolis of San Francisco from New York, where I was serving as the principal cantor at the National Archdiocesan Cathedral, which is an assignment that extends throughout the week. Is not only a Sunday assignment. I mean, you end up, you know, singing more than 250 services a year. That includes the matins, the preparatory service, you know, for the liturgical mass on Sunday, the divine liturgies, the vespers and the supplicatory canon services, and of course all the baptisms and the weddings and the funerals and the memorials. So it adds up, and it's most intensive some of the months, especially during the preparation for Easter and on the 15th, the first 15 days of August, where you have, you know, more than one services daily. If you are in a very, let's say, liturgically oriented community. So this is what I do, and I teach it as well, and I teach it to people of all ages, and I've taught at Hellenic College during my studies. I was already educated musically when I arrived in Boston to attend for my Bachelor of Arts, my music certificate and degree in chant. I had been awarded that from the Conservatory of Thessaloniki, and I was put to work, and I was very thankful for that, because it became one of the primary reasons why I got to travel in the U.S. and to visit for the first time the West Coast, and tour from Seattle all the way to the southernmost part of California, and from the Pacific to Denver and Utah and many other states. And so thanks to that, it's a expertise and the fluency that I have in all things Byzantine chant and Greek music, I was invited in Seattle, where I met some of your friends and families that, you know, met me at, I believe that the Folk Dance Festival at FDF, they heard me sing, and they asked me to go and visit with them and sing in some of the community events in Seattle in 97. Like, that was many, many, many years ago. In 96, 97 was the first year that I arrived in the U.S. for my studies. And since then, I've been going back and forth between America and Greece, and occasionally to Belgium, where I was born and I still have family yet.
Yes, quite the travels and quite the development. And as you had mentioned before, or when we were talking, there was also, you've been involved in quite a few other projects that involved more, again, of the Greek traditional stuff, and even Rebetka.
Growing up, again, I sang a lot of traditional and Greek art songs, like all of the entechna that we call in Greece, the music that of Chazidakis and Theodorakis and Xarchakos and all of the great composers. But all of those, again, are inspired also by the traditional and the rebetiko. And this I was aware and I was listening to, and I got to sing this repertoire while I was in Boston as a young professional student and performer. And we formed an ensemble, the Dunya Ensemble, with a fellow musician who has become a very celebrated composer, professor of traditional music and composition at New England Conservatory. He, Mehmet Ali is his name. He's originally from Turkey, but he is a music explorer as well, and a genius composer. And he brought us together to sing our shared musical traditions, and that included rebetiko. So professionally speaking, for this type of concerting that we did, I sang rebetika, and that has been, of course, recorded live in several stages in universities in Boston, and it has been memorialized in a historic recording called A Story of the City, Constantinople in Istanbul, that was produced by five ensembles, and I was involved in three of them, that represented all of the music of Constantinople throughout the centuries, like from the foundation, like from ancient Greek musical sparagmata, which is the remains of the musical codices that were found, that have some references to the ancient Greek intoned and sung odes of the Greek poets, and all the way to early, and then Byzantine, and then rebetiko, that is the direct continuation again of this tradition. So I've sent you a few links that have samples of these ensembles that included rebetiko, but also early medieval akritiki musiki, the music of the 12th century border guards of the Byzantine Empire, like in the Black Sea, the great poem by that refers to the legend of Vigenis Akritas, who was a brave heart of our neck of the woods, and he fought against the greatest enemies and even death. So one of the samples that you can listen to is the Akritiko song that I get to perform, and then later on one of the most popular, I guess, rebetika tragudia that has been sung by Dalkas, Matia Mou, Tone Matyon Mou Matia. There are different, I guess, titles for the same tune and the same theme, but I think we are calling it Matia Mou at this recording. So, I mean, this is music that is extremely powerful, no matter how you get to accompany it and sing it. I mean, it's stripped from a lot of excesses, and it is very visceral in the way you have to sing it and also experience it. And we have, of course, people that have taught us how to sing it, and they were living, like say, this music and making a living while doing it. And my references were those sound recordings, and I try to explore the experience, even, you know, if it's a young person, you haven't lived through heartbreaking circumstances, you definitely
kind of tragedy, you can learn. Yeah.
So this is music that I am extremely fond of, and recently I'm, you know, preparing and listening to some of the music by Dandonaki, who was a singer most known for her work with Manos Hadzidakis, who has sung, you know, some of the wonderful music of Rebetika as well, in a very unprecedented and sincere and evocative way, especially Ta Matoklada Sou Labun. It's an extraordinary rendering by the Donaki that is to be envied by all singers, of whom I am the least, or maybe the first. So we have a treasury of music, and it's really difficult to make justice to every single facet and every single style of music that is present and available in our traditional, let's say, music treasury. There's so much richness, and it's a lot of sophistication, and it's difficult to find, let's say, ways that you can sing every different style of music and do it justice, so you can be true to your sentiment of honoring that tradition, and also, you know, embrace maybe some aspects that you can imitate or emulate, and without making a mockery of it, but at the same time kind of carrying the torch, you know, to your fellow humans and future generations. So this is a double-edged sword, where you want to honor and do an authentic, let's say, rendering of a piece of music, and you have to inform it and represent it, να το παροντοποιήσεις, to make it present in a way that is insightful, and it is both contemporary but also, let's say, rooted in the authentic, let's say, tradition of singing every given song of our past generations.
I would definitely say that that's something we all do with in many different factors. We want to, like you just said, honor and show the beauty and the depth of something, but we don't necessarily have the time or the ability or really just to give it justice, to translate that depth, that the emotion. And I like the word you said, to emulate, because that's really all we can do, because we haven't lived through many of these, you know, these life events, you know, war and famine. And so all of this, whether it was music or dance, a lot of it came from these hard experiences, and people, you know, giving their soul out in a different form of expression through music and dance.
Yeah. I think also yes. With music, seems to be more documentation, you know, like if we compare this to dance and wanting to get back to like the root, the traditional, you know, the purest version of a dance, that's so hard to get to because things have changed, right? People have changed. How we move through the world has changed, but it almost feels like with music, there's more documentation of that to get to sort of the pure roots of that, or to bring in that tradition a little bit more easily. You know, just thinking about
the same. And I remember, thanks to listening to the podcast with Panagiotis Lig and probably others, that this has been hinted and discussed, where you do have a lot of documentation that also speaks of the variations of traditional, let's say, application or rendering, because you see the tradition, because it's a living tradition, and people, you know, have, it's, I mean, music and art is not a luxury, it's a necessity, and we've seen this in the results. Like the music and dance became like the binding forces, you know, for the community throughout the age, for them to sustain their identity and to inform their consciousness of, you know, who we are and who are the ancestors that we are direct descendants of. And what we see in this living tradition, where you have a melody that has been surviving throughout the ages, and then you do have, you know, from one point on, also recordings of various, let's say, ways of honoring this tradition, whether it is with a lira, which was the original and ancient instrument that went into the violin, and then, you know, for some people, the synthesizers, where they are presently in many orchestras, you know, substituted by keyboards that can play microtonal and synthesized, you know, sound likes of violins and other string instruments. And of course, along with the instrumental, let's say, evolution, you have also stylistic evolutions of things that, of course, have survived, and others that we have both or in various traditions of rendering with small t. So that's what gives us maybe the freedom and the right to embrace the process of trying to learn and to honor the tradition without hesitating to begin with. I mean, as long as the sentiment and the sincerity of the act of honoring is present, I think you can definitely give it a go, and you can play it even if you don't have the most authentic lira instrumentalist. You can play it with a piano. I mean, for example, Tamatoklada Sulabun, that was probably played, you know, to begin with in pandourides and sazi, and then in bouzouki, and then we have Dantonaki playing it with a piano. And we see this in so many traditional recordings, where you find it, you know, with a bagpipe in the beginning, and then you have it with a violin, and that was present as far as sound goes, because lira is basically the great grandfather of the violins and the cellos and the instruments of this type, and you see how seemingly without any second thought, you know, they were able to play anything they had available, because not everybody was maybe wealthy enough or lucky enough to inherit a violin or a lira, but they were able to have a little keyboard and before that, you know, other saduri and many other instruments that are of the same type, and they can be imitated by more contemporary music instruments. But yes, and I don't know if there was a question that I didn't answer, but I'm willing to hear it again.
I want to just go back really quickly, and this is like a little bit facetious, but so obviously I've never been to Mount Athos. That will never happen, right? At 6 years old, going to Mount Athos, like when you said that, I was like, I can't even imagine a six-year-old sitting still for that. Like, to how was that? Was that? Let me phrase it. Should I say, looking back now, do you think if you didn't have that experience, you wouldn't be necessarily doing exactly what you're doing? Like, I feel like that was such a formative experience. I mean, at 6 years old, that's huge. Yes.
There was a lot of similar music that I was exposed to before I went to Mount Athos. Mm-hmm. And it was a very inconveniencing experience, because I went, you know, from my village with electricity to a medieval little castle that had no electricity. And they were like with oil lamps. And I was like a little kid that I didn't know how to go to the bathroom at night. I was terrified. And the windows were broken in the room where we were offered, you know, hospitality. I got a little sick. I had a fever. I was like, oh no. I lost my father in all this, you know, it was a monastery at night with no electricity. And it was like all of them were wearing black. Try to find your father, who is my father is a priest, as I said. And I was it was a very intense experience, not necessarily a comfortable and a happy one, but it was definitely exciting. It was extremely exciting. And then, of course, as I said, overwhelmingly beautiful because of the music experience that I had. And I believe I'm thankful to have that experience because it motivated me to come out of my cell and say, I want to learn this. I want to teach me how to do this. And of course, before I was exposed to it, but that was kind of an initiative that was, again, came from within me and gave me maybe the opportunity to embrace this route for the time being, because we didn't know how things were going to evolve from that day on. But then I was inspired, let's say, to spend time learning something that not too many people were learning, and not certainly many of my schoolmates were not fond of this type of, you know, activity. And so, but thanks to that experience, even though it was a challenging one, I had the blessing to remember how moved I was and how beautiful I found it at the time, and I consider it extremely beautiful even today. So that's a good thing. So as far as parenthetically speaking now, women and Mount Athos go, I mean, Mount Athos was a preserve even from ancient Greek times. It was a place of pilgrimage for ancients of the Greek, the Hellenic tribes that lived in southern Europe over the last 3,000 years. And we know that there were temples, you know, to Poseidon and many other ancient Greek gods that were visited by people throughout the ancient Greek times. And it's not an easy site to visit. It's the third tallest mountain in Greece, and that results in the sea directly beneath it being extremely difficult to navigate or journey by. So that's why in the ancient historiography that refers to the Xerxes coming to take over Greece, they were unable to go around the peninsula of Mount Athos, and that's why they dug a canal during the ancient times, so they don't have to go around the peninsula, but they moved the ship across land in a very thin piece of land that is in the Ierissos area of Mount Athos. And as far as, you know, women visiting Mount Athos, as you know, maybe during extreme historical periods where, you know, we had the Greeks of Asia Minor that were driven away due to the massacres that were happening and the Holocaust in Smyrna and the genocides, the monasteries opened their gates and they received all these families that were desolate and they didn't have a home. So we have historic, let's say, periods that women actually lived on Mount Athos, and that happened also later in the 1940s and 50s, I believe. During the war, there was a lot of chaotic circumstances that allowed for you know, these changes to take place. Now, presently, women are still, you know, not invited to Mount Athos because only male monastics who wish to try and to dedicate their lives to God, but there is a little, you know, paradoxical thing going on. The Mount Athos Peninsula is dedicated to a woman, and this is the Virgin Mother. So it's the Garden of the Maid, and she has all of these different, you know, monastics to serve and to pray to her for everybody. But that's the little Mount Athos story. Presently, we have women going by chance or as a joke, as an anecdote. People, you know, in the past have been playing tricks on the monastics, and sometimes they take boats and they drive illegal women immigrants from Eastern Europe to Mount Athos just to make the news. I think that's the last I've heard. But, you know, it's Mount Athos is not unlike many other peninsulas in Greece, and we have two more peninsulas, let's say, in northern Greece that have the greatest, you know, seashores and bathing, the beaches, you know, for people to enjoy. Mount Athos is a climbing mountain and doesn't have, let's say, resort qualities like a lot of other places in Chalkidiki. But thanks to the difficulty of getting and accessing it, it has been able to preserve, you know, some of the greatest collections of music of ancient times, even like ancient, let's say, codices that have Pythagoras's, you know, music theories and other ancient wisdom from Aristotle to other philosophers. And all of this has been safe, kept in Mount Athos, and now they are available digitally to everybody, even if they are not able to visit themselves and have access, you know, to treat these, priceless materials. But I went another direction. We're going to return to Auckland.
I was going to say, so with that, I know you've had quite a few different projects, and with ERT, the Greek channel as well. Is there something you can... you're working on right now that you can tell us about, or
yes,
in the works?
Thank you. So during the pandemic, while being in New York and serving as the artistic director of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese, I invited the Polis Ensemble, which is a six-piece period instrument ensemble. They consider it to be one of the finest in Greece, if not the finest, by exemplary musicians. And if you don't mind, I can name them. But the Polis Ensemble: Alexandros Kapsokavadis, Manolis Klapakis, Theodoris Kuelis, Stefanos Dorbarakis, Nikos Paraulakis, and Giorgos Kontogeorgiou. These six people who play in many orchestras in Greece, like the State Orchestra and also the Xarchakos Orchestra, the Mixtothorakis Orchestra. They play with Katerina Papadopoulou and Notio Toxo, and they play with Nikos Xidakis in many of his recent performances with Evanthia Rebutika, and, you know, with great composers. These people had a project that I was invited to reflect and participate in as an informer, assistant, let's say, curator and producer. And this project, which is highly recommended for everybody who's going to listen to this podcast to find on YouTube, and they can listen to it for free, it's called Ellinikos Ichos, Hellenic Sound, by the Polis Ensemble. Polis meaning city, P-O-L-I-S. And it has an anthology of 15 compositions and suites, like amalgamation of music by some of the finest musicians who have informed the compositional tradition in the Greek East. But not all of these people lived, let's say, in Greece. Some of them were in as East as Russia and in Poland and in many other European countries, to include, of course, Constantinople and as far as Castellorizo and Crete and Athens and Thessalonica. And the anthology presents music from Byzantine composers, Peloponnesios and Berekétis, Hanendés, and all the way to the contemporary likes of Hadzidakis, Theodorakis. There's music by Skalkotas, his beautiful Cretan dances, and I recommended that we include the extraordinary maestro and composer Dimitri Mitropoulos, who is well respected but little promoted. I mean, he changed the course of music making in America, this person. He was the mentor of Bernstein. He was the conductor visiting to begin with of the Boston Symphony Orchestra and then the Metropolitan Orchestra of New York and the New York Philharmonic that was succeeded by Bernstein. And he was a composer as well as the most outstanding maestro, who was so thorough in his preparation of music when it came to conducting that he conducted without any score in front of him. He knew everything by heart, like in extraordinary and vast compositions, to know what every instrument should be playing, every single measure of that, you know, hour or 2 hour long symphony, let's say. And I knew, of course, of his extraordinary contributions thanks to an opportunity that I had to be invited to translate and edit a little known or not known series of notes on the history of music and morphology that were survived in a personal archive at Harvard University by Nicholas Zervas. Nicholas Zervas, who is still with us, is an emeritus professor of neurosurgery at Harvard, but a pianist as well. And he was the president of the Boston Symphony Orchestra Board of Trustees, of Board of Directors. He had this family gift of a manuscript of Dimitri Mitropoulos that they couldn't read well, and it was cursive, and it was with a pen. Sorry, it was with a pencil. So I had to use a magnifying glass and do a lot of successful imagination or imagining to be able to make out every single word and finally come up with the entirety of the text and publish it with Nicholas Zervas with the Livanis publication. And thanks to that invitation, I studied the life of Dimitri Mitropoulos carefully, because we all know and love Maria Callas, whose centennial from her birth we're celebrating this year, and a similar extraordinary music personage that we have from our country is Dimitri Mitropoulos. And we should definitely, you know, continue to bring him up and to honor him and to know all of his wonderful recordings and his contributions to American music education and life. So I asked the Polish Ensemble to include one of his composition so that we celebrate him, we include him in this lineage of, you know, Greek composers, that he was an outstanding one as well. So we included his Kithirian dances, which is inspired by, of course, the traditional four Kithirian dances that he chose. And then he developed, you know, this symphonic work that then the ensemble had to take, distill, and make it from a symphonic into a six-piece arrangement. And it's done beautifully and insightfully and very inspiringly. And you can listen to it pricelessly on YouTube, and definitely enjoy and honor the amazing Dimitri Mitropoulos. So this is an important project that ERT was involved in by donating studio time for the recordings, and also in kind of promoting the work because it's so encyclopedic. And next, that led into a project that is still being completed. I mean, the musicians have recorded their instrumental parts, but there are vocal parts that are going to be added. And this is a collection of medieval, traditional Christmas carols and dances that can be following these extraordinary music jewels. And that's a project that is again completed, and hopefully we have many more on the horizon. We have some ideas for, you know, new works and fantasies, like inspired by contemporary music but played by the traditional instruments of kanonaki and ney and lauto. And we do have a bass in the ensemble, and of course we have the Cretan lira and the percussion, of course. Along with this, and thanks to the familiarizing with each and every one of the wonderful players of this ensemble, I have a new CD that is going to be published this month in a few weeks by Stefanos Dorbarakis. He's the kanun player and piano player. He plays kanun in the group, but he's also a very good pianist and a composer. So we have one of his solo CDs that I'm producing for him. And it's definitely inspired by traditional music, but has a very soundtrack, let's say, aesthetic to it. And Stefanos worked with Revanthia, Rebuchica, I believe, but I know certainly he worked with Eleni Karaindrou, the famous Greek composer who has written the music for all of Theodoros Angelopoulos' film. So if you've seen Το Μετέωρο Βήμα του Πελεργού, or I don't know if you're familiar, he's one of the most prominent, internationally known Greek filmmakers. He has won the Palme d'Or in the Cannes Festival, and he was nominated for Oscars in the past. So Stefanos has played the music of Karaindrou and is included in her new CD soundtrack for Terrence Malick's. Terrence Malick, another Hollywood Oscar award-winning director, best known for The Tree of Life and some other well-known, you know, high A-profile, you know, A-list, let's say, actors playing in his movies. So, you know, just we do have extraordinary talent in Greece, as you know yourselves, and I am happy and honored to be able to help out and kind of bring to the whole world, you know, some of this music and make it kind of an easier bridge, you know, from Greece to the US and to the whole world, you know. And that's one of the little missions of augmenting and multiplying the appreciation and increasing kind of the possibilities. We do have so many treasures in all of our music and dance, and we need to continue to promote it and present it and let people interact with it and get all the beneficial nutrients from this music and dance of ours. And this, what you do is exactly that. You are getting the torch and you are putting oil on the oil lamp of Greek traditional music and dance. So we're thankful.
Thank you.
We thank you too, and for all your dedication and work to this, because it's not something easy, I would say, and it's definitely a big task. But as long as we keep doing it and people make that commitment, it'll just get better and better. And I guess this also kind of gives us a little segue to our other question we like to ask, as far as, and we've kind of briefly touched on it, is the legacy that you want to leave behind. What is it? Do you see that you would like to see with everything you've done and everything you're working towards for the generations to come?
I mean, teaching and helping people familiarize and be exposed to and be moved by this music and dance that I know and love is my desire, and I wish for it to be my legacy. It's for me, you know, this is something that informs my everyday life, and it's breath of fresh air. Is that how we say it? So it's extremely essential in my well-being as a human being, and the experience that I have had in celebrating life and participating in not just living, but ευζωία, I mean, in the good life, in the meaningful life, in the life of connecting. And we can connect better and easier through music and dance, and we know this, and we have reflected on it so much, and we have realized again and again how much of this language of ours and the history and all of the principles that we want to lead our lives by have been instrumental in the building of this music and dance tradition, like the holding of the hands and the supporting of one another, of bringing people together, and most importantly, of inspiring festivity and informing festival through music and dance. And last year, thanks to a beautiful Greek letters celebration in New York, one of the young students who was presenting by heart a Greek poem and a translation reminded me of one of the wonderful Alexandrian poets of our tradition, Kavathis's poem about the Poseidonians. And in preparation, like over the last quarter before we began our conversation, I reached out on the global web to retrieve this little poem that speaks about what you do and what we all, let's say, are doing when we come together in festivity. And maybe as a preface, we can say that I think it was Thucydides who said about the importance of festival, that a life without festivity and the experience of the joys of festivals, as we have, you know, grown to appreciate them, is a life. It is like a long road without an inn, he says. Like festivity, it's basically a life without it is no life at all. And definitely it's a dead end. There is no joy and no meaning. And in the poem Posidoniate of this Alexandrian poet of ours, he says, the Greek language the Posidonians forgot for many centuries, mixed up with Tyrrhenians and with Latins and other foreigners. The only thing left to them of ancestry was a Greek feast, with beautiful rituals, with lyres and flutes, with games and wreaths, and a habit toward the end of the celebration for the old customs to be told and the Greek names to say again, which were barely understood by a few. At the end of the celebration, there was always melancholy, because they remembered that they were also Greeks, as well as Italian for a while. And now, how they fell, how they became to live and speak barbarously, exiled, and a disaster like for Hellenism. But with the point that I want to make, thanks to the poem, is that in music and dance, which are activities that involve our hearts and bodies, and they become opportunities for a state of appreciation and meditation and kind of entertaining of all the meaningful things that one experiences in this culture of ours. And so it becomes a very fertile ground, the experience of the festivity, which is music and dance and wine, and basically kind lovingness, you know, of kind of appreciating life and, you know, beginning to embrace, let's say, one another and the humanity of one and all. And thanks to the teachings and the inspiration and the excitement and the intoxication that is not intoxication to a degree of forgetfulness, but it's intoxifying in the degree of arousing the appreciation and the excitement for the most meaningful things in our lives. And this is, you know, why we keep doing it, even if we don't have the words to express it and the way to articulate in the most meaningful and understand the best way to, for somebody to understand, you know, we experience it in the festivals that we have in our homes, and we invite our extended families and friends, and also in the communities of the Hellenes around the Americas and the whole world. What does the celebration that we have been experiencing while dancing and singing and exactly. bringing, yeah. you know, together and holding, you know, the hand of our fellow humans and compatriots and even our enemies, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. What's so interesting, we started this podcast during the pandemic because living in Washington, D.C. at that time, everything was shut down, right? And like many areas, but D.C. was a little bit more strict, right? So there was no dance, there was no this, and there was such disconnection. And the podcast was really a way to force an unnatural but reconnection of it. And if you would have asked me, like, back when that started, if I would have thought we would have dug so deep into a facet of music, a facet of Greek tradition that I have no real knowledge of, other than I go to church and I love hearing like Byzantine chant, like give me Byzantine, don't make it Americanized, don't modernize it, give me the Byzantine, right? I would have never thought that the podcast would have come to this, but there's such a striking connection. It's inextricable, right? You can't pull it apart from each other. And what you just said about even, you know, holding hands with enemies and with your enemy or whoever it is, it's that you're experiencing this together, and the fact that we can still experience this and that everybody in their own way works to support continuing to experience it is something that I pray never ends, because I don't know where else you can find something as rich as the Greek tradition of music and dance. And perhaps I have bias to that, of course, you know, but it's just, when you were speaking, what really struck me is what you were talking about. We can link back to ancient times, right? You know, beyond medieval, ancient, where these characters of Zeus and this and that are, you know, they're characters to us, right? But we can link it to that. And that's just, that's very heavy. Like, if you really think about that, that's wild. I would encourage people to take a second and really think about that. You know, it's the same thing with the traditions in the church, right? We have things that have persisted. We have saints that have not, their bodies are still, you know, intact, right? From the beginnings of our church in theory, right? Like the belt of the Virgin Mary, that I saw that on Instagram recently, post about that. That's amazing. That's not something that I believe exists in a lot of other cultures. And I would argue it's because people are working really hard to try to preserve it, like through what you're doing, through, you know, other, through the ensemble and stuff like that. And it's just really beautiful that people have dedicated their lives to this, you know?
So we're thankful, of course, and indebted to all of these people who have gone to extraordinary lengths, I guess, to preserve and relate to us extraordinary truths. And there is an abysmal, let's say, well of knowledge that we haven't even begun to appreciate. We know some of the people that have, let's say, reached very far down, and they have exhumed some of those, you know, the wisdom and shared with us. And just to trigger your maybe excitement, I don't know if you know, in the Greek dancing tradition, do you know why we hold the napkins and the mandili in the Greek dance? Do you know how far back that goes?
Tell me.
It's does our Seattle Patriot know why we hold not only hands, but also, of course, the mandili that can facilitate a lot of fancy dancing for the first, you know, dancer to do all of those the sophisticated and difficult things in the morning. But that goes far back to the myths of the Minotaur. And if you remember the story of the soldiers who were sent into with a line so that they can collect it and find the way back outside of the labyrinth. So in ancient Greek times, they were holding, in remembrance of that myth, a line, all of the different, you know, dancers around the orchestra where they danced, or the center of the estia, of the panigiri, they would hold this line made out of cloth that was representing το μύτο της Αριάδνης. So it was Ariadne web. Is that how we call it? It's the wool ball, like
the yarn. Yeah,
the yarn. So this is why we're holding mandili when we dance in 2023.
Amazing.
It's That's just awesome. It's very deep. It's very deep, and it's extraordinary and exciting. It's outstanding. It's very special.
Mm-hmm. That's so cool.
It's amazing, yes. So I am so fond of so many people that you have spoken. I'm gonna, you know, delve into the list of all the beautiful podcasts that you have. I listened carefully to some of them from beginning to end, and I had the chance to hear the extraordinary Panagiotis League, who is a legend. And recently in New York, I had the chance to go to Meraki dance by Dimitri Karabas or Karabas, and he's, you know, so special and so focused and dedicated and wholeheartedly given, you know, to this preservation, and not only preserving, just passing it on and sharing the wealth. And it's extraordinary. I'm waiting great things, you know, from him. He's extremely sophisticated and very, very challenging because he's so thorough in his dance and very demanding as a dance teacher. And he's a great one. So I'm looking forward to seeing. You know, he's the youngest generation, and he's also extremely musically educated. He composes music. You know, he's a Berklee graduate. That's amazing. And all of this thanks to your podcast for bringing, you know, people together and creating another treasury of information and reflections and oral testaments, however you call it. Yeah.